You're listening to the Author Stories Podcast, bringing you the story behind the stories and the storytellers.
Margaret Wise,
Terry Brooks,
Sheena Kamal,
Matthew Quick,
J.T. Ellison,
Walt D. Williams,
Brad Thor,
Corey Doctorow,
Brandon Sanderson,
Robin Mom,
Ernest Klein, Jim Butcher,
Sherilyn Harris.
Visit HankGarner.com for archives of all the shows. Today's guest is... Thanks for joining me again for the Author Stories Podcast, where I bring you the story behind the stories and the storytellers. Today, I'm really excited to have Bruce Van Dusen on the show with me today. He has an amazing new book. It's called 60 Stories About 30 Seconds, How I Got Away with Becoming a Pretty Big Commercial Director Without Losing My Soul, or maybe just part of it. Bruce, I absolutely love this book. Thank you for joining me on the show today.
Thanks for having me, Hank, and thank you so much for saying such a nice thing about the book. I'm glad you enjoyed it.
It's so fun. It's funny in lots of places, and it's a great look into the realities of being an artist and being a commercial artist. And commercial, I mean, in the fact that you directed commercials, but also an artist who depends on his art to make money. That's an important thing that we lose sight of a lot of times.
That was very, very, very astute comment. You know, the weird balance that many of us have to navigate between art and commerce. And one of the things I learned relatively quickly, once I discovered that there was this business of being a commercial director, was that it was exactly that. You know, you were making little stories, you were filming them, you were dealing with actors and technicians and editors and words and locations. You were making what looked like some sort of movie or TV show, except inevitably someone was going to start talking about a deodorant or a cereal or something. So the commerce part of the art form of filmmaking was right in your face every day. But you know what? As you know, having read the book, I kind of came to terms with that pretty early. And I don't want to say it necessarily embraced it, but it didn't make me crazy. It made me, I understood that I was really lucky. In fact, I was stunned that somebody was paying me money to run film through a camera.
Absolutely. Bruce, I kind of jumped right into the show without doing what we do at the beginning of every show. And that's we begin each show with the same question. And that question is, what is your first memory of wanting to be a writer or storyteller? And since the book is about your journey as a different type of storyteller, what was your first memory of wanting to tell stories, whether it be in film or in written form or however that happened for you?
I have a very vivid one about writing, where I, for some reason, had my sights set on being able to use a typewriter when I was young. And I was able to hoodwink my parents into buying me a tiny little portable, whatever it was, Royal or Olivetti or something. And it fit, you know, it was about the size of a lunchbox.
Yeah.
And this was maybe first grade or second grade. It was definitely elementary school. But I thought when I would carry this around, I just thought I was the shit. And, what I would do was start to write these little stories about the people in my class, other second graders. And I would, you know, some would be interested in reading them and some wouldn't. The teacher read maybe four or five of my stories and she said, "You must never write again because these stories could hurt people." And I kept typing. I just didn't take the typewriter to school anymore. But probably better that I started with a really bad review. So, I'd been a reader, and then probably by about fourth grade, I got my hands on a little beat up Super 8 movie camera, and I started to try to, you know, figure out how to do stories that way. So, you know, now that you mention it, I realized that I was, you know, I seemed to have some crazy idea that I had stories in me and I could get them out. But the written ones definitely came to an abrupt halt for a period of time because I thought, oh, man, I must not be doing that right.
Well, I love to ask people that question because those early memories and things that we hold on to really fuel our creativity in some of the dark times that artists, you know, have to go through. You know, whether you're a writer and you're writing a novel, you know, for 8 months to a year without anyone ever seeing it, and it's lonely, and there's, you know, all of this doubt that comes, and you know, you tend to hold on to those early memories that fuel you through that. I also love to hear where you got early rejection and you continued on despite that, or do you feel like that early rejection fueled you in some way?
I think it did fuel me a little bit because I thought, hey, you know, wait a second, Teacher McGillicuddy, it's second grade. I'm typing stories. Give me a break here. This is like an accomplishment.
Right.
And, you know, I guess I just wasn't, I know the content wasn't so offensive. I think it was just that because I wasn't writing about, you know, like a Hardy Boys story. Definitely, I have found that being, you know, getting pushed back or being told no, rejection has more often than not acted as fuel for me. It gets harder and harder, I'll be honest, to have it, to experience it that way. But I think it's a big part of being a young writer or a young director. I don't think you're going to succeed unless you can somehow turn rejection into an energy that you're going to use to your advantage. That's going to push you forward.
So Bruce, you go to Boston University. You wind up with a degree. First off, what was your degree in?
I have a Bachelor of Arts in Film and Television Production. That was some little, you know, they have many different colleges at BU. It's a very large school. So it was called, the college I was in was called the School of Public Communication. So you could get a degree in journalism, a degree in marketing, a degree in radio, a degree in film and television production, stuff like that.
So with that degree, you decide to go to New York City to be a documentarian or a documentary filmmaker. When you had that desire, did you have a topic in mind, or did you just have the art form in mind and that you would go looking for a topic?
I had always been a little bit fascinated by the big gaps in income inequality, income equality and income inequality, whatever it was. And I'd made a little film in Boston when I was working as an intern at the Kaiser Broadcasting Station that was juxtaposed this, you know, very well-to-do young couple on Beacon Hill with a super hardworking lower class couple originally from Sicily who owned the little deli across the street from my horrible apartment. So I think I was interested in these ideas of in these big ideas. I wanted to do something about Parchman Farm, this prison in Mississippi that you know, figures in so many blues songs. Why? What the hell does some white kid from the Northeast want to do that for? But it sounded good. And then, so I think I was trying to, you know, I think I had big eyes, big appetites. And as you read in the book, I was rapidly schooled in what those dreams were going to entail.
So you wind up in New York with a little bit of cash in your pocket. What was the impetus that got you into commercial filmmaking? And at what point did the desire for documentary start to wane a little bit and you realized, you know, I've got to do something to make some money?
Well, I pretty quickly, because I came to New York and I had $150, so I had to get a job. And so I was completely 100% focused on food and shelter. I thought that if I went to interview at the documentary companies, the network divisions that were doing documentaries, things like that, that I would be able to, that would be a good way to go find a job. I didn't know that the commercial industry existed. And I'd gotten a little bit of a come to Jesus lecture in Boston from Frederick Wiseman, who's now still one of the huge forces in documentary film. He, at that point, was not as big a guy. He lived in Boston. I mean, he was so not big, his number was in the phone book. So I called him about 2 weeks before I moved to New York and said, basically, I want to be you. How do I do that? And he gave me a sort of 10-minute lecture on the fact that filmmaking was primarily about documentary filmmaking was primarily about convincing other people to give you money, and that it was really hard. You spent very little time actually making films. You spent most of your time looking for money. So that enabled me to come to New York and say, I'll look for anything. And I wound up on a commercial entirely by mistake because my roommate, who had a master's degree in film and television, got a job on a commercial where he was going to drive a truck around New York City and pick up props. And he called me from the garage the morning that his job started, quite distraught, and said, do you know how to drive a clutch? And I said, I do. I'm a guy. Why? What do you mean? And he said, I don't. And he said, I can't drive this truck. Will you come down here and bail me out? So I did. I went down, drove a truck on what turned out to be a Minute Rice commercial. And I walk on the set and I see 70 men working, and the man who's photographing it is the same DP who had was photographing all of Woody Allen's films, the production designer, the same thing. So I was watching these famous people make a day's wage making a commercial, and I thought, I should see what this is about. So was definitely, I kind of gave up pretty quickly on documentaries because also I was out of money. And you learn very fast that working on documentaries was horrible pay, if there was pay at all. And as I say, I was driven by food and shelter and being able to do something that was in this industry rather than stand around, you know, and be working, you know, driving a cab and telling people I was a director and I had a script.
A lot of artists, whether they be novelists, whether they be filmmakers, you know, someone that has ideas of writing this really important history book, whatever it is, that they go through a stage where the art is very precious to them and they treat it very preciously, and I use that word in all of its connotations. You tell this fascinating story about how you should be prepared to take any meeting, no matter what it is, no matter what the circumstances are, because you just never know what's going to come out of that. touch on that story a little bit, if you would. I think you're nodding your head like I think you know what I'm talking about. But also, if you would, talk about the ideas of art being precious, as opposed to, you know, finding ways to not compromise your values while also, you know, making a commercial product.
It's a very complicated area for a lot of people. I would tell you that I think I admire people who are so devoted to their art that they don't care about any sort of critical response. They don't care about a commercial success, meaning a monetary success, a market success in the marketplace. They are just so devoted to what they're putting on a canvas or what they're putting on a page or what kind of an image they're creating on film that it doesn't bother them. They have a vision. I just was never that way. I always felt like if I was going to be successful in doing my craft, and it took, you know, listen, it took me a long time before I referred to directing commercials as being a craft. But once I had decided that it was a craft and I'd learned that I was pretty good at it, I also came to feel very at home with the idea that, of course, I wanted to be commercially successful and recognized for it. And of course, I wanted to be able to have my work seen and appreciated by more than my girlfriend or my parents. I think that part of it, I have to answer it as a filmmaker first rather than as a writer, because when you're making a film, whether it's a commercial or a movie or a documentary, it has no value until it has an audience and an audience that's going to react to it somehow. It's kind of secondary if they pay $8 to see it in a movie theater, if they say, pay $15 or they see it on video on demand. But it requires an audience. And it requires an audience for you to be validated as the person who's made it. Writers, I think, can get away with, painters, I think, can get away with having what they work on private for a lot longer. But as in one of the chapters, I say, God, you know, if I spent 3 years doing something and the end result was it just went away, or it went into a drawer, or no one wanted to see it because I couldn't get a gallery to exhibit my pictures, I would be very frustrated. I would think that I had failed. There are many people who would disagree with me on that, but I really think that artists, whether they're using words, whether they're using paints, whether they're using cameras, whether they're using their bodies, I think they want to be recognized. And I think a little that is the easiest way to understand that is they want an audience of some kind.
Scribophile is a respectful online writing workshop and writers community. Writers of all skill levels join to improve each other's work with thoughtful critiques and by sharing their writing experiences. We're the writing group to join if you want to find beta readers, get the best feedback around, learn how to get published, and be a part of the friendliest and most successful writing workshop online. Improve your writing by receiving detailed critiques. Learn from a vast collection of free writing resources. Make lifelong friends in our busy community of writers. Writing is a solitary art, but that doesn't mean you have to be lonely. Lucky for you, there are thousands of writers on Scribophile every day, and we're a really friendly bunch. You've never seen a writing group like this one. Join Scribophile today at scribophile.community.
So the book, 60 Stories About 30 Seconds, is, you know, tracks your career, the ups and downs and all of the funny stories that happen along the way and all the people that you meet. Just for a second, let's put your author hat on for just a second. When did you decide that you wanted to put this book together, and what was the motivating factor that made you want to collect these thoughts and put it into prose?
I've had a very long, like way too long career. Commercial directors usually last maybe if they last a year, maybe they last for 5 years, 6 years. So I've been doing this for 43 years. I have no idea why. And I feel like I've overstayed my welcome like by decades. But the one of the things that happens if you do this for 43 years and you get to be somewhat successful at it is that a lot of things happen to you. And, you know, I would be that jerk who would, you know, be at dinners with people, friends or new people that I was meeting, and they'd ask me what I did. And, you know, everybody goes, oh, yeah, that sounds really cool. What is that? And, you tell a stupid story or two. And then you realize, oh, you know, some of them were probably good little short vignette-y kind of stories. And I had continued writing, particularly for the last 20 years, what had happened in the commercial business is that in order to get jobs, you used to get on the phone with people. They'd send you a storyboard and you'd get on the phone and just shoot the shit with them and kind of describe how you thought the job would go. And then as the business became more structured and completely nuts, advertising agencies began to say, well, after we talk to you, we want to see a long written treatment of what you're intending and a huge visual representation, folders and this and that. So people would, people would be sending in 20,000 word documents about how they were going to make a 30-second commercial. This struck me as insane, but that was the business I was still in. So in the beginning, you know, I would play along with it. I mean, people would write, Hank, they would write two pages on light. They would say, you know, the light is going to cascade through the window at an angle that reminds you of the summer solstice with the, you know, and I couldn't do it. You know, I would just say, light's going to come, we're going to light it and it's going to look beautiful like everything else that I do. So, and you know, my producers would say, Bruce, this is horrible. You can't do this. You seem like you're dispatching them. I said, yeah, but the other is just such crap. It's not going to work. But I was writing enough and writing a little bit about how I was going to do things that I started to realize that I could take some of my experiences and turn them into sort of a series of blackout sketches. I didn't know whether I could turn it into a book that would cohere. And I mean, you're a brand new acquaintance of mine, and you're a perfect person for me to ask that question of, because you read it without knowing anything about me. So I'm really interested whether you felt like, oh, I kind of understood what happened over that 50 years.
Oh, yeah, it's fantastic. And I felt like I was on the journey with you. I felt like you were a tour guide of sorts. And
that's great.
Yeah, it was really amazing. Bruce, 2020 has been a bit of a dumpster fire, and not anything that we expected it to be. You know, you writing this book right now is fortuitous, because we've seen a lot of, I can't really grab the word that I'm looking for. It's been a bit of a reckoning, with, you know, some of the Hollywood elite, and we've seen a lot of people out of work, and that's very unfortunate. You know, a lot of film production has just shut down and television production. And we see some of these people that have been on pedestals, you know, having to kind of become one of us. And we see talk shows on TV that are, you know, via Zoom and Skype, and, you know, we see people in their home habitats, and it's very weird. It's very, you know, a lot of the luster has been taken away from Hollywood. You talk about in the book about treating these people like regular people, and a lot, and, you know, dealing with the A-list celebrities and that sort of thing. You know, 2020 has done a lot of that, but you were doing that long before this came along. What is it about treating people just like the regular people, no matter what their status and, you know, what celebrity list they're on or whatever? Do people just want to be people at the core?
It's a great question because it touches on both individual and group psychology. I made a choice early on when I would get thrown into situations where I had to deal with very famous people, and I was pretty young. It was clear to me that they would look at the situation and they would look at me, you know, Clint Eastwood was probably late 40s or 50s, the biggest movie star in the world, and I'm this 32-year-old director, and he gets out of his car and looks at me, and I was pretty sure that his take on that was, oh my God, what am I in for here on this? So I found that if instead of trying to come across as some, you know, know-it-all, some big cheese, you know, trying to make very complex what was happening, if I just was like, hey, Clint, how you doing? You want a coffee? We're going to go over here. I found that really, really well-known people very much enjoyed, or at least responded well in a work environment, to being dealt with as a regular person, because they go home and they're regular people. So sure. I felt like this was a way to kind of, it certainly wasn't going to replicate what their life was at home. We were all new. They were surrounded by all these new people, but I thought, oh, it'll make it seem low key. And I found that it worked for famous actors. It worked for famous athletes. It worked for presidents. It kind of worked for everybody. And I think maybe it had to do also with the fact that I believe that famous people get tired of being famous. And if you kind of create an environment for them where you're like, I don't care who you are. Come on, let's go do this. They're like, really? And you go, yeah, let's just go over here and go, you know, it's no big deal. They're like, oh, good, great. Because I've seen the other, you know, I've seen people who go in and they start genuflecting or kissing the ring or, you know, oh my God, I've seen this film of yours 15. Oh my God, Jesus, that would make you uncomfortable.
Right.
So I just chose not to do that.
And too much of that, you know, causes this other phenomenon where people talk about themselves in the third person. And there's a really funny story in there about that. But just connecting with people on a human level kind of disarms people from these sort of reflexive, you know, things that they put up and like talking about themselves in the third person. Maybe it helps to humanize the process a little more. Trying to say.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, I think anything that sort of takes away from who they are, you know, you just don't mention it. There's no reason to if you're working with an actress and she's doing a television commercial for you, there's no reason to bring up the fact that she's won an Academy Award. It's irrelevant. That's kind of why she's there. Everybody knows she's won that. Who cares? What's more interesting is where she ate dinner last night, or you know, what book is she reading? Or any little effort at normalcy, I think, I think works. You're referencing this one story. You know, I would encounter people who were just mental. And that, you know, in defense of actual famous people, that guy who I described, who got in an elevator with me and began talking about himself in the third person, was a commercial director. And I mean, seriously, what we do is stupid. It is stupid. So I mean, maybe I would get it if Elon Musk went in and started talking about himself in the third person. He's a little kooky. Maybe Dave Chappelle might do that. Maybe David Foster Wallace once talked about himself that way. But let me tell you, a commercial director, no. And it was just proof positive that this guy had really taken leave of his senses. And I just felt lucky that I was only riding, you know, like 9 floors with him. I thought, oh my God, there are people who go to the office with this asshole every day. Jesus.
Let's talk for a minute about the idea of collaboration, because in book writing, like we mentioned before, it's a very solitary endeavor until that draft is done. And then, you know, there's editing and all of that. But then when you turn that draft in, then it's going to go, you know, to an agent probably. Then it's going to go to a publisher. And in that publisher, there's going to be an editor. And this editor is going to, you know, make a pass at it, send it back to you. There's going to be changes that make you send it back to the editor. You're going to go through, you know, proofreaders. And there's a bit of collaboration that goes on the back end of that writing. And in commercial making, you would think that that's a very collaborative process. But you talk in the book about there comes a point where someone has to just take charge. Do you feel like the collaborative nature of making commercials and writing a book, do you feel like that there's a connection there? And at what point do you say, okay, collaboration is not helping us here. Someone's just got to take charge, and this is my vision ultimately. And do you draw a comparison or a parallel between writing and commercial making and the collaborative nature?
I think that filmmaking, is one where there really needs to be one person in charge. The writer is going to come up with, is going to put a script together. The director is going to find a cast. The cast is going to figure out how to make those characters come alive. An editor is going to add a certain amount, restructuring, affecting the tone. But if the director doesn't really have a solid vision of where he or she wants to take it, somebody else is going to take over, because somebody has to lead. So a weak director may really cede control of the picture or the commercial to the editor, or if they're working with a big star, or to, you know, a performer who's going to do it. I always fought to, and I use that term by its dictionary definition, it's really a struggle as a director in America on commercials to control the process, because the agency wants to come in and tell you how to realize it. They want to tell you how to direct the actors. And then in a standard commercial in the United States, when a director finishes shooting it, he's done. It goes off to an editor, a commercial editor, that the advertising agency has hired, and they go and edit the commercial 85% of the time with no involvement from the director. Now, that was insane to me. I thought, Jesus Christ, you know, you're paying me a lot of money. I kind of know why I shot it the way I did. Let me go and do my job here. In certain cases, you're made... people just say you're not welcome. You're not welcome here. So fight, it would be problematic. Juxtapose that with Italy. I did a great deal of work in Europe over the years, particularly in Italy. The Italians treat you even as a commercial director, the lowest of the directors, still as the auteur. And their expectation is you're going to cast the commercial, you're going to shoot the commercial, and you're going to they're going to leave you alone for a week while you edit with the editor and put together what you want. I loved Italy. I mean, I couldn't believe they were paying me to go to Italy and make commercials, but I loved the process more. Now, writing has been really educational to me because, as you say, you spend big chunk of time by yourself, not sharing it. And I think it's good to not look for input early because I think it takes a bit to figure out what you want to do. You got to go down, at least I did. I had to go down certain pathways and go, that works. That doesn't work. Okay. Try to build it back up. This book had a hard time finding a publisher. Very hard, particularly because the editors would write back and say, I loved this book. I laughed all the way through. I really learned something. And I'd sit with my agent and go, why don't they want to buy the book then? It's too good? And every editor would say, I have no idea who would be interested in reading this book. And I thought, well, I think people on Earth would, because, you know, it's about something that no one knows anything about. In any event, once it was sold, I was able to then work with a really, really smart, skilled editor who was not at the publishing house. He was someone who I chose to bring on because I felt that he would really elevate the product. The publishers, I think, were happy with the book as it was. I felt like it could get better. So this gentleman's name, you may have heard of him, his name is Will Dana, and he'd been the editor-in-chief of Rolling Stone for about 20 years. So he'd edited Matt Taibbi. He'd edited all these wonderful people. And fortunately, I shared the book with him, and he said, I really like your book. I think it's a great book. And I said, so give me the butt. He goes, well, you know, you could be better. And I said, well, can we work together on this? And he was kind enough to do that. And watching a really good editor, Hank, is just like watching a great editor on a film. They just do things you didn't imagine. They say, this doesn't matter. This matters more. I'm moving this here. I found it very, very similar to a good film editor.
Absolutely. And what a great product the book is in its final state. 60 stories, about 30 seconds, how I got away with becoming a pretty big commercial director without losing my soul, or maybe just part of it, is an amazing book. Bruce, I love this. I love getting to get a glimpse into something that I was very familiar with and not familiar at all. You know, commercials are one of these things we just take for granted and we have no idea what goes into it. And some of the funny stories behind it and all of the people's lives that are involved in it. We're going to put links to the book in the show notes of this episode to make it easy for people to find it.
Right.
Bruce, if people are, you know, fascinated by your story and want to dig into all of the great stuff that you do, where can they find you online?
I'm easiest to find online at brucevandusen.com or on Instagram, Bruce Van Dusen, all lowercase, numeral one. It looked like you were cheering for me. It's just because some other schmo named Bruce Van Dusen got there first. So that was the only way I figured out to put the thing on the back end. Didn't realize how stupid it made me look. But they can find it there. And they'll be able to also, if they're still teasing around with interest on the book, you go to the website, my website, brucevandusen.com, and the first chapter of the book is there in its entirety. So that may lead you in, and then you can go back to the home page, and it's got links to all the different sites where you could buy it, which I hope people do. It's a fun book. I'm so glad to hear you enjoyed it, and I think it's also a good moment for it. You know, we are in just madness at the moment, and this is a little bit of a break. It's not like just listening to a stand-up comic, but I think it's a good parallel break. Somebody was saying to me today, how come all these books have all these long titles? You know, this, and then there's the subtitle to it. I said, you know, I don't know. I think most people don't know anymore that 30 seconds was something that was the sole format for commercials, because now content is everywhere.
Sure.
You know, the branding is really different. They said, do you have any other ideas for titles? And this was this morning, view of what's happened yesterday, the only other book published. I said, yeah, I was going to go with Rage, because that's what I felt all the time. But I said, this stupid guy Woodward, I don't know what the, you know, I think he ripped it off from me, but it doesn't matter. So he can have the angry title. Mine is more a little self-deprecating,
but endearing all the same. Bruce, no, congratulations on the book launch. When we're recording this, I think the book came out yesterday. When people are hearing this, it'll have been out for a couple of days. But what, you know, the excitement of book launch and people getting the book and all of that is going on right now. But are you thinking about the next project, and what are you working on next?
I am thinking about the next project. I have way more than 60 stories. So if this happened to catch on, there are certainly more of them. I'd like to really try something different. What I did love about writing this, which is a memoir, but it's also a nonfiction book. And I'm a big nonfiction reader. I'm a big reader, but I'm also a big nonfiction reader. So I've got a couple of different ideas about, in essence, long form journalism that intrigue me, but ones that I can do and structure in the same way that 60 Stories is structured. Very short bites about being able to go in and out and allow readers to sample it in that particular way. I think it's one of the things that I resisted. I don't know if you find this in your reading style and taste, but when I pick up a book now and I see that the first chapter is 62 pages, I'm discouraged. Yeah. I'm really discouraged. And when I see a book that is just, I don't care if it has 140 chapters, but I see these shorter things and I go, oh, that's good. And I don't know whether it's because I think my attention span has stopped, or it's just that a little bit of writing has changed. It's like when I pick up the New Yorker now, I don't even bother with that one story in the middle, you know, the 35,000 words on orange pits. It's okay. Great. Good. Send me the cliff notes on that one. But I can do, you know, when I'm reading Granta, same thing. I gravitate to something that's tighter, particularly with nonfiction, because I love to learn.
Well, you know, we've got hundreds of books that come out every month. Our viewing options are, you know, just off the charts. There are lots of things vying for our attention, and I understand, you know, the need for long, slow storytelling and really build the art of the buildup, and there's a place for that. But we also have to respect people's time and the fact that they chose to give us some of their time when there are so many options. And that's one thing that I love about this book. And I can't wait to see what comes from you next, Bruce.
Oh, well, thank you so much. Very kind of you to say. And I'm so thrilled that I've just been so thrilled that all these people I'm meeting for the first time doing this have been able to enjoy the book. It did start out as a little bit of a double-edged sword. The first couple of these I did, the host said, you know, they sent me this book and I got it and I looked and I thought, I'm just not interested in this. I don't want to read this. It looks really, really not good. And then I started to read it. And then it was an hour and a half later and I'd read half the book. And I said, can I use what you said? But we got to get rid of the first, it's editing. I got to get rid of the beginning part of it. But
can I get rid of the backhanded part of the backhanded compliment?
Yeah. And you know, they were offering it up as a real compliment. I got it. But I thought it wasn't really till the third one that I'd start nodding my head as I'd hear it. I'd go, here it comes. Here it comes. I didn't want to, I hated your, you know, the title. I didn't want to read your, who wants to read about, this is the one thing I would say to the listeners is I really had to make sure that a lot of people understood this is not about advertising. This is not a book about being in an advertising agency. There's plenty of those that have been written. This is not that. This is this weird little corner of filmmaking. And I think, therefore, that's what makes it a much more interesting book. Because it's not about, oh, the fight I had with the brand manager when they did this with Pepsi. This is about filmmaking and doing it in a very, very strange sort of context because of the fact that you're doing this weird balance of art and commerce.
And what a fantastic and fascinating. 60 thank stories, you. About 30 seconds. There's a link to it in the show notes. Bruce, thank you so much for sharing some of your time with us today.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it. And I hope everybody who listens thinks about buying the book.
World Anvil is a browser-based world-building platform designed for all world builders, writers and novelists, dungeon masters, game developers, and everyone else. World Anvil keeps your world settings safe and organized, helps you find your characters, locations, plots, timelines, and maps quickly and easily as you write. Then, if you choose, you can showcase your amazing world building to the world, beautifully and interactively, to keep your readers engaged. You can even use our professional tier to build your career, selling access to behind-the-scenes content your readers will love, and growing your community. Build your world setting in any genre with over 25 custom-built world-building templates, complete with prompts to inspire your creativity. Allow your readers to explore the public parts of your world in an innovative new way with interactive maps, timelines, and wiki-style articles. Give special access to co-authors, beta readers, customers, or patrons to see exclusive behind-the-scenes content. There's a free version to get started with all of the major features. Guild membership offers you a host of extra options, including comprehensive privacy settings, co-authors, presentation options, and so much more. Join our community of over 800,000 world builders, including professional authors. Take part in competitions and learn more about world building at this fantastic online community. Use the coupon code HANK to get 20% off all 6 and 12 month subscriptions. WorldAnvil.com. I'm a recent convert and I know you will be too.